Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Concluded. Cassette 12, Side 2.
Why, you could go to Oxford, or back to Harvard, perhaps, work at the language, go into the diplomatic, or anything you fancy. It'd be nuts to a chap like you. I've got some standing, you see, and money.
Elspeth's, but what the devil?
I want to help you, to get on, you know.
He touched his pony's mane.
Why? Do you think you owe it to me? Yes, but that's not why. You saved my life, and I can't pay that back. But it ain't for that.
Is it because of what you did to my mother?
Good God, no. Look, my lad, I'll tell you something about me, which you may well have gathered already. I don't know what conscience means. Or rather, I do, but I haven't got one. I don't give a damn. Your mother, I played her a damn shabby trick, and we both know it. She tried to play me an even shabbier one in return, and it's only the grace of God and you that she didn't succeed. But it's nothing to do with any of that. You're my son.
I found I was grinning hugely with a great lump in my throat.
Such a son. And there you are.
The light was fading fast, but I heard him chuckle.
Serve you right if I took you up on it.
But it wouldn't do.
God's name, why not? If you didn't like it, you could chuck it, couldn't you? Look, my boy, you simply have to say what you'd like to do best, and we'll do it. Or rather, you will, and I'll help anywhere father can. I mean, I know what strings to pull, and corners to cut, and palms to grease, and backs to stab.
Do you mean it?
What I like to do best? Absolutely. Anything at all.
Well, Papa, says he, the thing I'd like best is to ride back over the ridge there. I sat for quite a little while after he'd said that, and then I said,
I see.
No, you don't, either, says he dryly. It's nothing to do with my mother, or with you. I said I didn't care much. Don't care anyone special, except old Sue, Miss Backheart. She was the nearest thing to a mother I've had. God knows why, I've no remarkable objection to my father.
He laughed at me.
Do you know, after Greek Rye, I went down on the Suraking camp. I was wishing I could lay claim to you publicly. There were only two warriors they were talking about, apart from themselves, naturally. The soldier with the three stripes, and the leader with the long knife on the saddle horse. What do you think of that, now?
God, the irate. And if I was screaming scared, either he nor they would have listened there. The same old deception, the same old false appearance. But I was glad.
So, it's nothing personal, you see, says he, and turned his face to the western sky where the fame and gold pale blue fading of the day died. It's just over there is where I live.
But Frank, says I earnestly, Frank, boy, what's over there? Quade scouts mutter, and you ain't gonna rot on it. And there's nothing on that you can do as Frank Carrada. You couldn't do far better and bigger and richer out in the wide world. Truly, you don't belong here, even if you think you do. You're half me and half your mother, and we ain't Westerners.
But I am, says he. I'm not English or French or black or American. I'm Sioux.
I can see that stark profile now, the raised head with the feathers behind it, outlined dark against the evening light, and remember how my heart sank and the emptiness within me as I made my last throw. You're nothing of the damn sort. There ain't a drop of Indian in you, whatever you feel, because of how you grew up. That's natural, but it'll pass, you know. And if you was Sioux to the backbone, don't you see the life you've talked about so much this past week? Well, in a few years it will have gone.
I was leaning forward in my saddle, positively pleading at the dark figure.
Believe me, boy, I saw this country when hardly an axe or a wheel had been laid on it. I rode with Carson from Towers to Laramie, and we never saw a house or a wagon or crossed a road or a rail the whole damn way. That was the year you were born, just yesterday. How long do you think it'll take before it's all gone, vanished? Greasy grass was the last kick of a dying buffalo. The Black Hills have gone. The powder will follow. There'll be no more free plains anymore. No game, no spring hunt, no... My voice trailed away and I shivered in the cool night wind. He took up his reins.
I know.
His head was turned towards me and I saw the crooked grin in the shadow.
I was at Greasy Grass too, you know. And I'm glad. For your sake. But not just for your sake. Not by a damned sight.
Before I knew it, he'd wheeled his pony and was off up the darkening slope, the hooves hollow on the turf.
Frank!
I roared. He checked at the crest and looked back. I felt such a desolation then, but I couldn't move after him or say what I wanted to say with all the sudden pain and regret for lost years and what had come of them. I called up to him.
I'm sorry, son. About it all. Well, I'm not.
He called back and laughed and suddenly lifted his arms wide either side.
Look, Papa.
He laughed again and then he'd ridden over the skyline and was gone.
I sat and looked at the empty ridge for a while and then rode on, feeling pretty blue. I'd only known him a week and he was a Sioux Indian to all intents. And when you thought of all the bother there'd been about him with every deadly sin, I suppose, for his godparents. But if you could have seen him, by Jove, he looked well. Still, it was quite a relief. Paternal piety's all very well, but it would have been a damn nuisance if he'd taken me up. I had meant what I'd said, mind you, about starting him right and seeing him get on. But now he was gone, and I could look at the thing cold. It was just as well. He'd possibly have been a tricky, troublesome beggar. Elspeth would have asked the most awkward questions, and once he'd cut his braids and put on a decent suit, the likeness would have been there for all the world. Quite. I came all over of a sweat at the thought. Yes, undoubtedly it was just as well. Yet, sometimes I hear that laugh still and see that splendid figure on the ridge, arms raised, and I can feel such a pang for that son. But life ain't a bed of roses, and you must just pluck the thorns out of your rump and get on. I was in cheery fettle next day as I rode over the last winding miles of hill trail into Deadwood Town. It was a regular ant-heap all the way in, with the miners crawling over the tree-clad slopes, and the ceaseless thump of picks and scrape of shovels and ring of axes, and ramshackle huts and shanties and sluice boxes everywhere, with dirty bearded fellas in slouch hats and galluses cussing and burrowing, and claim signs all along. Sweetheart mine, crossbone diggings, damn your eyes gulch, and the like. The town itself was bedlam. It was only 4 months old then, and wasn't much but a single street of log and frame buildings running the whole winding length of that narrow ravine, which can't have been more than a couple of furlongs wide from one steep forest slope to the other. But they'd lost no time. Already they had a mayor and corporation, and a grand central hotel, and a bathhouse, and stores, and theatres, and saloons, and gaming houses, and dance halls, with clerks, and barbers, and harlots, and shopmen, and traders, and drink enough to float a ship, and everyone beavering away like billio, and doing a roaring trade. Boom, they called it, and just to see it sent your spirits sky high. It was so busy, and jolly, and full of fun. For everyone was riding high and spending free and about to make a fortune. As I rode through the dust of the bustling street, the music was tinkling in the honky-tonks. The stores and saloons were full. The roughs and tarts chaffed at the swing doors, and the sober citizens hurried by, rosy with prosperity and optimism. They say you couldn't get a seat in the church of a Sunday either. And Greenland's icy mountains and Oh Susanna were sung with toleration and goodwill next door to each other. And now and then somebody got shot, but in the main everyone was happy. There wasn't a dollar in sight, though. Just gold dust. It changed hands in little pokes. Even at the bars they were paying for drinks with pinches. And there wasn't a counter or barrel head in town without its scales and weights. Dust bought everything, and I had none, or a dollar either.
I strode into the hotel and slapped down the gold hunter which the Minneconjurer had turned his nose up at. And the burly Teuton behind the desk looked at it and me in my beard and buckskins and sniffed suspiciously. "Where you get that then?" Taking me for a road agent, you see, so I pointed out the inscription and assured him in my best Pall Mall drawl that I was the party referred to. He mumped a bit, but grudgingly allowed me $30 on it, and I signed the register, and 10 minutes later was sound asleep in a hot tub, and all the grime and aches oozed away from me, and with them the turbulent memories of the Far West, and Mrs. Candy's patched eye, and Jacket and his braves, and the stinking stuffiness of the teepee, and walking blanket woman with her knife at my cords, and the horrible bloody riot on that yellow hillside. Copper bodies bounding up the slope, screams and shots and flash of steel, the rattler in the grass, Custer tossing me the bulldog. "Hello then, Colonel, long way from the horse guards." The sorrel bounding beneath me, that painted face under the buffalo cap. "Lie still, whatever happens." The grave and handsome face splitting into its crooked grin. "How do you do, Papa?" His hand in mine. "Frank. Frank." I woke up in the cold water, shivering, while someone pounded on the door and shouted was I going to stay in there the whole damn night. A good steak put me to rights, and I was sitting bone-tired and content in their noisy dining parlour, debating whether to buy a brandy at their crazy prices, and thinking happily that I'd be back in Philadelphia with Elspeth before the week was out, when someone swung my gold hunter on its chain before my eyes, and I stared up at a man I hadn't seen in 10 years. Tall chap in a broadcloth coat and fancy waistcoat, long hair and even longer moustaches carefully combed, smiling down at me while he swung the watch. He burst out laughing as I jumped up and pumped his hand, and then we roared and exclaimed and slapped each other on the back and called for drink, and then we sat down and grinned at each other across the table. "Well, Harry, my boy," cries he, "and what the eternal hell are you doing here? I thought you were dead or in England or in jail." "Well, James," says I, "you weren't far wrong on the first two counts, but I ain't been in jail lately." "I'll be damned," he beamed and pushed over the watch. "I just saw our good mine host fretting over this at the counter, wondering if it was brass after all, and when I took a squint, why, there it was, Sir Harry Flashman as ever was." He slapped the table. "Old fella, you look just fine." "So do you, and see how you like it. Here, though, he gave me $30 on this watch, you know." "$30? Why, the goddamn German vulture pried $50 out of me. Say, I'll just have his fat hide for that." "Sit down, James," says I. "I'll send you $100 for it when I get back east." "You going east? Why, you've just arrived. And where the hell have you been, and how are you, and what's your news, and damn your eyes, and so's your old man, and have a drink." So we drank, and he swore again, laughing, and said I was a sight for sore eyes, and what the blazes brought me to Deadwood. "It's a long, long story," says I, and he cried. "Well, we had all night, hadn't we?" and shouted to the waiter for a full bottle, and keep 'em coming. "No, by thunder, we'll have champagne," cries he. "If I'm drinking with a baronet, I want the best." "I'm not a baronet, I'm a knight." "Oh, that's right, I forgot. A knight of the water closet." "All right, the goddamn bath," roars he. "A long, dark, dirty night. Now then, fire away." So I talked and we drank and I talked and we drank and I talked, because for some reason I was perfectly ready to tell the whole thing from the beginning, when I'd knocked Bryant downstairs at Cleve, to the moment when I rode into Deadwood. Deuced indiscreet, probably, but I was careless with content, and he was an old friend and a good egg, and I felt the better for the telling. He whistled and guffawed and exclaimed here and there, but mostly he just sat quiet, with those strangely melancholy eyes watching me, and the waiters kept it coming into the small hours, and steered other patrons clear of us, and roused the cook to bring us ham and eggs at 4 in the morning. Nothing too good, you see, for Wild Bill Hickok and his guest. When I'd done, he sat and stared and shook his head. "Flashy," says he, "I heard a few, but that beats all. I'd say you were the goddamnedest liar, but here, let's see your head."
He peered at the newly healed wound on my scalp and swore again.
"Holy smoke, that's an Arapaho haircut, sure enough. Your own boy? By damn, that's thur. That's hell. I don't know what. And you were with Custer? No fooling? In that massacre?"
"Don't spread it about," I begged.
"I want to go home nice and easy and no questions and have a good long rest. So forget it. And what are you doing anyway? Last I heard, you were in the theater with Cody."
So he told me what he'd been up to. On the stage, and here and there, a little peace offering, a little gambling, drifting a good deal. But now he was married with a wife back east, and he was in Deadwood to make a pile so that they could settle down.
"Mining or gambling?" I asked.
And he grinned ruefully and pulled back his coat, and I saw the two long repeaters reversed in the silk sash at his waist.
"If the cars don't start running smarter, and unless I can wrestle up enough energy to try the diggings, I'll most likely have to put on a badge again."
Well, that was money for nothing to him. He was the finest and fastest shot with a revolver I've ever seen. Though I'd have paid money to see him from a safe distance against Jack Sebastian Moran. He wouldn't have to do a stroke as marshal. His name was enough. But he didn't look too content at the prospect. Studying him, I saw he'd put on a touch of puffy weight over the years, and wondered if booze and loafing were closing in. He confessed that his eyes weren't what they'd been, and he was ready to call it a day if he could take a small pile east from Deadwood.
"I'll give it a few more weeks," says he, "and make tracks before fall. Hey, Tom, what's the date?"
The waiter said it was August the 1st if we were still in last night, but August the 2nd if we reckoned it was this morning.
By Jove, another couple of months, and Elspeth would notice there was someone missing. I asked the waiter when the stage left for Cheyenne. "You're not going out today?" grumbles Hickok. "Hell's bells, we haven't but had a drink yet. What's your hurry?"
He wagged a finger.
"You've been racketing around too much, that's your trouble. You're plumb excited and can't settle. Now what you need is a good sleep and a mighty breakfast in the evening. And then get Totter and Dick's hat band. And there's the crackiest couple of little gals of the Bella Union. And we'll peel the roof off of this town. And your father's a clergyman, too," says I. "I'm sorry, James, but I'm all set. Look, why not come down to Cheyenne with me and we'll ring the fire bells before I catch the train east?"
But he wouldn't have it, the lazy devil, and we strolled out onto the porch of the hotel to look at the stars and see that the drunks were lying straight in the gutters. It was just coming to dawn and I was dead beat.
"I'm too late to go to bed now," says Hickok.
I snatched a few hours' sleep, though, and piled down to the stage office just in time to catch the southbound. There was the usual crowd of roustabouts and loafers and boys to see the little coach pull out, piled high with boxes and bundles. There were only three other inside passengers, an elderly couple and a sleek little whiskey drummer in check pants and mutton chops. They were already in their places, and the driver was bawling,
"All aboard! All aboard for Custer City, Camp Robinson, Laramie, and Cheyenne!"
As I ran down the side street with the kids whooping encouragement and scrambled in, we set off north, and the little drummer explained that we would circle the block and then head south out of town.
"Goods to pick up at Finnegan's and Number 10, he explained.
We took on a case of his samples at Finnegan's and rolled down the broad main street, which was busy with wagons and riders, to the Number 10 saloon. Hickok had said it was a haunt of his. Sure enough, he was taking a breather on the boardwalk as we pulled up. He had his coat off and his two guns in full view.
"Still time to come along, James," I cried from the window.
But he shook his head as he came across to shake hands.
"I've got Skipper Massey inside there," says he, "and I'm going to bluff, raise, and call him from hell to Houston. Ah, beg your pardon, ma'am, forgive my thoughtless speech." he added, raising his hat to the old lady. Very particular that way was J.B. Hickok. Much good it did her, for now the driver discovered a linchpin sprung and his language poisoned the air. A boy was sent scurrying for a replacement and a hammer, and Hickok winked at me and called, "Don't take any wooden nickels, Flashy," as he sauntered back into the number 10. The driver thrust a crimson face in at the window, saying, "Just 10 minutes, folks, and we'll be on our way," and we sat patiently in the Deadwood stage, watching the world go by. "Beg pardon, sir," says the whiskey drummer, leaning forward. "Did I detect a British accent?" I said coolly that I believed it was. "Well, that's delightful, sir." He raised his tile and extended a paw. "Charmed to make your acquaintance, indeed. My name is Hoskins, sir, at your service." He rummaged and thrust a card at me. "Traveller in fine wines, cordials, liqueurs, and high-class spirits." He beamed, and I thought, "Oh, God, he's let him get off at Custer City." It was hot, and I was dog-tired and wanted peace. "May I say welcome, sir, to the great American West? Ha! You've been here before? Well, I trust your present trip is as enjoyable as the previous one."
The seventh packet of the Flashman Papers ends here, without further comment or elaboration from its author. On August the 2nd, 1876, the day on which Wild Bill Hickok was shot dead in the number 10 saloon, Deadwood. Appendix A. The Mysterious Lives of Frank Gruart, 1850-1905. The most remarkable thing about Flashman's claim to be the father of Frank Gruart Standing Bear, the famous scout and mysterious figure of the American West, is how well it fits the known facts. That he should have had a son by Cleone, and that son should have grown up among Indians, is in no way surprising, given the circumstances of Flashman's relations with Cleone. Their child was not unique in this way. Half-breed children raised as tribesmen were common enough. Custer himself is supposed to have had a son by a Cheyenne woman, although in the light of Custer's character, this may be thought unlikely. Nor was it unknown for a man to be able to pass equally well as Indian or white, apart from Flashman himself. There are plenty of witnesses to testify that Frank Gruard did it, with a success that still baffles historians as much as it did his contemporaries. Or one might cite the case of James Beckwith, the mulatto who became an Indian chief, returned to the white side of the frontier and then took to the wilds again. However, to Gruard, there is no doubt that he scouted for Crook in the 1876 campaign and was regarded as the best frontiersman with the American army. But who exactly he was or where he came from was less certain and the subject of much controversy. Some thought he was white, others that he was Indian. Another theory was that he was half Indian, half Negro, which is interesting. Yet another that he was the son of a French Creole. More interesting still, Gruard himself, after having refused many offers from journalists for his life story, and having lost all his records in a fire at his home, finally dictated his story entirely from memory in 1891 to a newspaper man named DeBarta. It was a most curious tale. Gruard said he was born at Paumotu in the Friendly Islands in 1850, the son of an American Mormon missionary and a Polynesian woman. That he was brought to the U.S. when he was 2, lived with a family named Pratt in Utah, and ran away at 15. He became a teamster and mail carrier and was captured by Sioux in 1869. He was so dark that the Indians took him for one of themselves and spared him. The name of Standing Bear was given him by Sitting Bull personally, because Gruard had been wearing a bearskin coat when captured. He was with the Sioux for 6 years, was a special favorite of Sitting Bull's, and knew Crazy Horse well. He became, naturally, fluent in Siouan. In the spring of 1875, Gruard decided to leave the Sioux. He came into the Red Cloud Agency and, his own words, stayed until the commissioners came to make the Black Hills Treaty. He does not say that he went to Washington with Spotted Tail, but there is no reason why he should not have done so. After the failure of the treaty,
He was sent as an ambassador on behalf of the whites to Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, who rejected peace offers. And there are those who say they did this at Guard's suggestion, and that his loyalties lay with the Sioux. In any event, Guard says that he returned to the Red Cloud Agency, decided to become white, and enlisted with Cook. This he certainly did, and scouted for him in the March campaign on the Powder, and later on the Rosebud. It is worth noting that one of his fellow scouts at this time became suspicious, and told Cook he suspected Guard of plotting to lead the command to destruction. So much for Guard's own story thus far. His movements as a scout for Cook are sometimes well documented, at other times not so. After the Rosebud battle, June the 17th, he appears to have been in and out of Crook's camp. He was certainly not with Crook on June the 25th, the day of Little Bighorn, or for 2 days thereafter. When he did return to Crook, it was with the news of Custer's disaster. For the next few weeks, Guard's movements are accounted for, but towards the end of July he fades away again. Now, all this fits exactly with Flashman. But there is more. According to DeBarter, Guard's biographer, a story was current that Guard joined in the attack on Custer's force at Little Bighorn, but not with the intention of defeating Custer. On the contrary, Guard had supposedly been trying to lure the Sioux to destruction against what he hoped was a superior American force. But the plan miscarried, and the Sioux won. At this point, the imagination begins to reel slightly, but it is interesting that a rumor was going about that Frank Guard, scout to Crook, had fought with the Indians at Little Bighorn. On balance, Flashman's story of Guard's early life is more plausible than the one Guard told himself to DeBarter, and all the mystery and confusion surrounding Guard and the 76 campaign go to support Flashman rather than not. After 76, Guard scouted in government service, and Book and Finity, reliable sources, agree with Crook that as a woodsman, he stood alone. But no one was ever sure what to believe about him. The Dictionary of American Biography notes of his life story that it is fact liberally intermixed with highly wrought fiction. Flashman students may be interested to know what Guard looked like, in the light of Flashman's description. He was 6 feet tall, swarthily handsome, weighed about 16 stone, had a large head with black hair, large expressive eyes, prominent cheekbones, a kindly humorous mouth, firm chin, and large nose. Appendix B. The Battle of the Little Bighorn. Perhaps the reason why so much has been written about this famous action is that no one is sure what happened. There is nothing like ignorance for fueling argument. Because until now there has been no account from a white survivor of the Custer part of the fight, the speculators have had a free rein, and what one eminent writer has called the great American faker and the great American liar have flourished. This is the more extraordinary when one considers that Little Bighorn was not, except to the participants and their families, an important battle. It settled nothing, it changed nothing. It was, as Flashman says, not really a battle at all, but a big skirmish. And yet, Little Bighorn has an aura of its own. It is impossible to stand on the Monument Hill, looking down towards the pretty river among the trees, or walk across the ridges and gullies of greasy grass slope, with the little white markers scattered here and there, showing where the men of the 7th Cavalry died, or look up from the foot of the hill at the silently eloquent cluster of stones where the last stand was made, or the distant ridge where Butler's marker stands solitary. It is impossible to look at all this and listen to the river and grass blowing without being deeply moved. Few battlefields are more haunted. Perhaps this is because one can stand on it, and this is rare on old battlefields, see what happened, if not how. However they came, on whatever course, is unimportant. Any soldier or civilian can envisage the retreat from the river and coulee to the ridge and hill. for here there are no complex maneuvers or great distances to confuse a visitor. Just a picture of 200 men in blue shirts and a few in buckskin fighting their way across a sloping field, pursued and outflanked by overwhelming numbers of an enemy, determined to fight them in their own way, man to man and hand to hand. Purists and propagandists alike dispute over terms needlessly. In the English language, it was indeed a massacre. Flashman's account, in fact, is not one for the controversialist. Apart from his eyewitness detail, he does not help much to clear up the questions, most of them fairly trivial, which have raised such heat and fury over the past century. The great Reno debate is not affected in any matter of fact. Only in his opinion does he touch on it, and supports the majority view. What did happen, then, at Little Bighorn? So far as one can see, after studying as much of the evidence as one can reasonably digest, Custer split his command into three as he approached the roughly southern end of the valley, where the Indian camp lay. He sent Benteen to the left, went himself along the right flank of the valley, and ordered Reno to charge into the valley itself. The idea was that while Reno was attacking, and possibly sweeping through, the camp from end to end, Custer would fall on it at a convenient point from the right flank, or possibly rear. A reasonable plan in view of Custer's previous experience. Reasonable, that is, on the assumption that he did not know the Indian strength. Reno did not get far. He was checked, and eventually, with Benteen, who had come up, established a position on the bluffs, where they held out until the Indians withdrew. Custer, meanwhile, had seen the camp from above the valley, and determined to attack it. Here we enter the realm of uncertainty. Looking from the bluffs today, and knowing how big the camp was, it strikes one that Custer was ambitious. His scout, Boyer, certainly thought so. "If we go in there, we won't come out," and a pretty little quarrel ensued before Custer followed his own judgment and went down towards the ford. How far he got, we do not know. The precise movements of his five troops, we do not know. These things do not really matter. We know where they ended up. In the event, Custer obviously mismanaged his last action. How far it was his fault, for not having got better information of the Indian strength, for failing to assess it properly when the village was in sight, for exceeding the spirit, if not the letter, of Terry's orders. These are things we cannot fairly judge without knowing what was in Custer's mind, and that we can only guess at. It looks as though he was unjustifiably reckless in deciding to go in with his five troops. With hindsight, we know he was, but how it looked to him from the bluffs, he was there, and we were not. Looked at from the Indian side, it was a competently, even brilliantly, handled action. For a people unused to war or battle in the conventional sense, the Sioux and Cheyenne fought greasy grass in a manner which would have been approved by any sound military theorist. They turned back the initial attack, held it, saw the danger on their own flank, and enveloped this in turn. Reviewing it from their side, and this is personal opinion, it seems to me that Flashman is right to give the main credit to Gore. Although Crazy Horse's circular movement was an inspired use of cavalry, Gore as the anvil and Crazy Horse as the hammer is a fair simile. But it was an extremely mobile anvil. One other point it seems fair to make. Reno came under heavy and unjustified criticism, initially from Custer's hero-worshipping biographer, Whittaker, later from others. He was subsequently cleared officially, and barely a week after the battle, four-fifths of the surviving rank and file of the 7th Cavalry petitioned Congress asking that Reno be promoted to fill the dead Custer's place. After that, what do critics matter? The number of books and articles on Little Bighorn is literally uncountable. Those against which I have checked Flashman's story, not only of the battle, but of related subjects, number close on 100. So I am listing here those which readers may find of particular interest. Foremost must be a work which, though outstanding, is curiously hard to come by. Fred Dustin's The Custer Tragedy, 1939. It and those two splendid works by Colonel W. A. Graham, The Custer Myth, 1943, and The Story of the Little Bighorn, 1926, are the three books which no one interested in the battle can do without. The research of these two authors has been prodigious. Colonel Graham's collection of letters, memoirs and interviews, and Dustin's great bibliography have been immensely helpful. Here, for example, one finds Gaul's account of the battle, given to General Godfrey in curiously touching circumstances, as the two old enemies walked over the battlefield 10 years later. Here, too, Mrs. Spotted Horn Bull's story, and Two Moons, and Bentine's lively reminiscences, and Wooden Leg's story, and the Crow's Scouts, and the arguments of survivors and critics. Also, Whittaker, Custer's Life, E.S. Godfrey, General G.A. Custer and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, 1921, Brooke, On the Border with Crook, Miller, Custer's Fall, Vestal, Sitting Bull, 1972, E.I. Stewart, Custer's Luck, 1955, Miles, Personal Recollections, Dunn, Massacres, Finnerty, Warpath and Bivouac, Hansen, Missouri, Deland's Sioux Wars, Custer's My Life, and Mrs. Custer's Boots and Saddles and Following the Guidon, P.R. Trobriand, Army Life in Dakota, 1941, O.G. Libby, Arikara Narrative of the Campaign of June 1876, 1920, P. Lowe, 5 Years a Dragoon, 1926, A.F. Mulford, Fighting Indians in the U.S. 7th Cavalry, 1879, Mrs. O.B. Boyd, Cavalry Life in Tent and Field. But there are many others, and among them I should mention the late William Smith of Regina, Saskatchewan, former scout for the Northwest, later Royal Canadian, Mounted Police, who served in the Indian Wars and whom I interviewed more than 30 years ago. And for those who want to know something of Little Bighorn that cannot be got from books, let them travel up the Yellowstone Valley, past the Powder and Tongue to the mouth of Rosebud Creek, and then take the Lame Deer Road, past the great modern mining works, which Custer and Crazy Horse never dreamed of, and follow the Rosebud to Custer's campsite, and so to the bluffs and the river, and walk across the greasy grass. This concludes the reading of Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. This book was read by David Case. Additional titles by George MacDonald Fraser in the Books on Tape library include Flashman at the Charge, Royal Flash, and Flash for Freedom. For additional information about them, or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalogue index to find review material. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate, so the book will be in order for the next person to enjoy. Thank you.